Who's entitled to cast a mail-in ballot? A new lawsuit says the Attorney General's advice might have broken Texas election laws. We'll try to sort it out today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Is 2020 the year Texas turns blue? A perennial question reemerges with a little more oomph this election cycle. Also, oil plummeting, rising unemployment. What else? A new report on a hit to the Texas economy few in our major cities are talking about. And the decisions faced by some families on whether to get loved ones out of Texas nursing facilities. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 12th day of May 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your Tuesday's been a good one so far. Aside from the usual and by now predictable partisan sniping over lockdown restrictions and or the relaxation of the same, it can be somewhat jarring to be reminded of this political fact. Pandemic or no, the election is on. Although one can never say never, it is hard to imagine a more untenable position than for officials to try to postpone an election that before the era of lockdowns was projected to be one of the most consequential in American history, something that is arguably all the more true today. In case you missed it, not only are the primary runoff elections in Texas still set for July 14th as scheduled, Governor Greg Abbott has announced a change to early voting. Instead of starting on July 6th, Texans can begin casting runoff ballots on June 29th, 2 weeks earlier. Sticking with the original schedule, in Abbott's words, quote, would prevent, hinder, or delay necessary action in coping with the COVID-19 disaster. But how far should state accommodations go? Should every Texan be entitled to cast a mail-in ballot? According to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, the answer is a resounding no. He has advised elections officials statewide that fear of contracting COVID-19 does not entitle voters to cast mail-in ballots. And he's even gone further to say that those who encourage others to apply for a mail-in ballot may be criminally prosecuted. Well, now the Attorney General himself is being accused in court of committing an election crime by providing an intentionally misleading statement to election officials. Here to help us understand what's what, Charles Rocky Rhodes. He is professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Wonderful to be here today, David.
So we have two things actually going on here. We have this criminal complaint against Paxton, and then we have a lawsuit challenging the state's vote by mail, Rhodes. Let's begin with a complaint against Paxton. What is he being accused of, election fraud of some sort?
So this is kind of a what's good for the goose is good for the gander type argument. The criminal complaint against Paxton is that he has been intentionally misleading voters with respect to their ability to obtain a mail-in ballot, just like he's trying to claim that others are trying to open up mail-in ballots to too much, and that's fraudulent. So essentially what's happening is you have two different interpretations of what are the mail-in ballot requirements, and both sides are essentially accusing the other of engaging in criminal fraudulent activities by stating the other's position.
Wow. Now, then we also had a suit filed yesterday challenging the state's absentee voting restrictions. What's that part of it about?
That's a news suit that just got filed yesterday. And in that particular case, you have a situation where they're making various challenges to the very process of the mail-in ballots, which right now require that you have to mark the ballot, put it in an official envelope, and then place and seal that ballot envelope and get stamped. And they're saying in the midst of a COVID-19 pandemic that some of those activities that are required with respect to your ballot are dangerous and violate your due process rights.
Who's behind these suits? Is this political activism, or how do you interpret it?
Well, some of it is individuals like the Texas. One of the suits that's going on in Austin, which is also implicated on all of this, is the first suit that the Texas Democratic Party brought, along with a number of interveners, including the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, that tried to argue that with respect to the Texas rule that says that you may apply for a mail-in ballot when you have a disability, and a disability is defined as a sickness or physical condition that prevents the voter from appearing on election day without the likelihood of needing personal assistance or injuring the voter's health. That applies to all of us that don't have immunity to COVID-19, because that's a physical condition that will possibly create an injury in a situation in which you could be exposed to other voters who were there at the polls who might have transmission of the disease.
Professor, forgive me for interrupting, but I just want to ask you, if you actually were not immune to something, wouldn't that effectively make vote by mail on demand, because we're all not immune to any number of dangerous diseases that are out there?
Exactly right, David. So the position of the Texas Democratic Party is essentially that everybody should be entitled to mail-in ballots, which, of course, is the position that is being strongly opposed by Ken Paxton.
So what does this look like going forward? What could November elections actually look like?
Right now, it's too early to say. And in fact, a lot of the arguments that Ken Paxton's office filed, their argument is, well, it's too early to tell. All this should be thrown out because we should wait until it's closer to the elections to be able to know what is the status of the pandemic. You know, in addition to their argument that it's got to be some kind of physical condition, but it's pretty clear that under the statute, if you have diagnosed disease, a sickness or physical condition that can put you at risk, it seems to me that this is pretty clear that you have the ability to do a mail-in ballot. So if you're immune compromised or if you have heart problems and we still have the pandemic effects going on at that point in time, that seems to me to be a clear meeting of the definition. The Attorney General's office hasn't said that that's okay yet specifically, but they've never tried to say that that's not enough either.
Right.
They keep
right.
saying that fear is not enough, but that if you have something that may be more than just fear, that there is this underlying condition, that could possibly, not possibly, I think under the statute, you're entitled to a mail-in ballot.
We're going to see how this thing plays out in the days and weeks to come. Rocky Rhodes is professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, David.
For years, Democrats have predicted Texas will turn blue someday, and demographers have long talked of a tipping point as the population changes. Donald Trump's single-digit victory in Texas in 2016 and Ted Cruz's narrow re-election to the Senate in 2018 have been held up as evidence that Texas is no longer the solidly red state it once was. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider raises that perennial question: is this the year Democrats take Texas?
In Brazoria County, one of the largest Republican Party precincts stretches from Lake Jackson toward Highway 36 along the Brazos River.
It is a very, very conservative precinct, overwhelmingly Republican.
But Becky Green, who chairs the 30th precinct, is anxiously watching the northern part of the county nearest Houston.
We have a lot more of Houston sort of moving down south. And so we are seeing more people registering and voting Democrat in that part of the county.
Jacinda Valencia is one of those recent arrivals. She moved to Pearland from Houston's East End 3 years ago and now chairs Democratic Party Precinct 13.
If you look at the public election data and information, you'll see that there are sections within Brazoria County that are purple and blue.
It's a trend Valencia sees repeating in most of Texas' major urban areas.
So if you look at most of the metro cities like Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Austin, they are already blue and they're highly concentrated. As you shift further out and zoom out further in the map, you start seeing purple cities.
Republican Becky Green isn't worried about what this means for the Texas GOP as a whole.
I think that we're sitting back watching what's going on in the cities. And I think that we're all very disturbed by that, but that's having a positive effect. It's getting people kind of riled up. We're registering tons of new Republican voters across the state.
In past years, that would have been more than enough to keep the state safely in the Republican column. But Texas is approaching a tipping point. The population in the state's 27 most urban counties is close to surpassing that of the state's 200-plus rural counties. Political scientist Richard Murray of the University of Houston says that urban growth could finally turn Texas into a battleground state as early as this year.
These interconnected economies, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, it's a relatively small part of the state, but 84% of the growth since 2010 has been in these Texas Triangle counties.
Murray says that the Latino vote is driving much of the shift from red to blue. He notes that Hispanics are voting in much larger numbers than in the past, as more and more children of immigrants reach voting age. But he says Texas Republican Party could not have chosen a worse time to pursue anti-immigration policies. He points to another once solid bastion of the GOP.
We could go the way of California, which went very damn fast. You know, California was a very Republican state in things like governor elections in the 1980s and even the 90s. Then all of a sudden, everything collapsed.
That collapse came in large part because Latino and Asian Californians abandoned the GOP after the party pushed to deny state services to undocumented immigrants, a ballot measure the courts later struck down. In Texas, the numbers are not looking good for the GOP. A Dallas Morning News University of Texas at Tyler poll shows Trump in a virtual dead heat with presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Joining us now, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing about the story at the top of the show, voting by mail, and the flurry of lawsuits over whether or not to expand the practice. Here's what we're hearing on the Texas Standard Facebook page. There, Jonna Blackley writes, in the midst of a crisis like this, it's only logical to allow more voting by mail, but logic has no role in politics. Robert Flood writes that it works for property tax payments, bill payments, and other government-required payments, but not for voting. Are Texans paying attention to this anomaly, he asks. And Morgan Hamilton is upset about the legal wrangling and writes, unless things change with mail-in ballot applications or better testing and possibly a vaccine, I'll have to risk my health and that of the people around me just to exercise my right to vote. Some of the reactions we're seeing, David, I'll be back with more later in the show.
Hey, Central Texas, as we are on the air on this Tuesday morning, we've got some severe storms moving through the area. Keep it right here for the very latest. And, of course, take care of yourselves out there. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Times. A whole lot more of the Standard just ahead, so stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The ongoing coronavirus outbreak has exposed the vulnerability of the nation's nursing homes when it comes to spreading of disease. With that in mind, some local health officials have suggested families consider bringing their loved ones home where they may be safer. KERA's Saida Hassan talked with one woman who fears bringing her mother home would be less safe.
It's been about 2.5 years since Trisha Meyer's family decided to move her 95-year-old mother into the Cottonwood Creek healthcare community in Richardson. Meyer says her mother, who has dementia, needed round-the-clock care when her cognitive health began to decline.
She was unable to feed herself, care for herself hygiene-wise. The dementia, of course, she would get turned around in her own home. So it was just getting to be unsafe for her.
In late March, Dallas County began seeing clusters of COVID-19 transmission at nursing homes and assisted living centers. The outbreak exposed how easily infectious disease can spread within these communities, where many residents have underlying health conditions and live very close to each other. To date, more than a third of COVID-19-related deaths in the county have been associated with long-term care facilities. Health officials have asked families to consider bringing relatives home to reduce their risk of exposure. But that isn't an option for everyone. Tricia Meyer says putting a loved one into long-term care isn't an easy decision, but neither is taking them out. She's overcome feelings of guilt about not being able to care for her mother at home. During this pandemic, Myers feels her mom's in good hands, under the care of professionals.
They have very strict standards. Certainly no place is perfect, but I feel very comfortable with Mama being there, the care she is receiving.
Other families, especially those who have lost loved ones, are seeking accountability. As the outbreak grows, the federal government is now requiring nursing homes to report COVID-19 cases to residents and their loved ones, as well as to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The University of Texas's Dell Medical School is about to graduate its very first class of physicians. The celebration was expected to happen on May 21st, but much like other schools, the ceremony has been moved online because of the global coronavirus outbreak. Nadia Hamdan of KUT Austin wanted to know what it's like to become a medical doctor in the middle of a pandemic.
Ava Karimi wanted to study medicine for as long as she can remember.
But while I was back in Iran, I couldn't because of my religion. I actually couldn't go to university. It was basically it was more like a dream than a reality.
But when she was 18, her family moved to Dallas.
And when I came to the U.S., I realized that all the opportunities are open to me.
Karimi started volunteering in hospitals and says the more she did, the more it felt like a calling. So she started looking into different medical schools and ultimately chose UT's Del Med, becoming one of the 50 students in its inaugural class. She says to be a part of this first group of med students was a privilege.
Thinking about it, again, very emotional. I remember the first day that we all came in to our medical school. We were basically, really the first 50 people that were just, walking around and feel like we own the school. It's our school. So it was a very interesting experience.
Then came four long, exhausting years of medical school. But through it all, Karimi kept her eyes on graduation day and her goal of becoming a doctor. Then COVID-19 hit.
Now, it's a new reality. It's completely different than what you've ever imagined.
We all were just really seeing it as the goalpost that we were going to run across in concert with the students. And there was a lot of anticipation and excitement. And then, obviously, COVID-19 hit, and all things changed in almost a heartbeat.
Dr. Beth Nelson is the Associate Dean of Undergraduate Medical Education at Dell Medical School. She says they'd been watching the coronavirus at a distance when it first popped up in Wuhan, China.
And so we were monitoring, observing, keeping an eye on it. Frankly, even those of us in healthcare not fully understanding what it would mean when it hit our front door.
On March 13th, the day before spring break, UT Austin officials announced they were going to shut down the campus, and they wanted Del Med to do the same.
And so there was a lot of confusion about what to do and where to go, and students had already gone into the hospital for their clinical rotations that day, and then they were being called and said, everyone must go home. So that was quite a shock to the system, I guess I would say.
Medical students need to complete hands-on clinical work to graduate. This means they rotate through different areas of a hospital, such as surgery, pediatrics, OBGYN. You get the idea. But the Association of American Medical Colleges recommended all students be pulled from these clinical rotations because of safety concerns. Hospitals were struggling to get enough personal protective equipment for doctors, let alone med students. So this meant half of Del Med's inaugural class had to find another way to get those credits.
They were very anxious, and many of them did not want to leave on Friday the 13th because they were afraid that their graduation possibilities would be put at risk.
Karimi was one of these students.
And this comes the moment of uncertainty, knowing, I only have this couple of months left. Would I be able to finish medical school in time?
Del Med was able to quickly create virtual courses that would help the students get their credits. They were using avatars instead of real patients, but at least it was something. One professor even created an entirely new elective course called the COVID-19 Pandemic, Global Health on the Front Lines. The class focused on things like the principles of public health and the history of pandemics. The course even gave students some of that hands-on experience they were missing. Amber Basinger is another fourth-year Del Med student who took the course. She was put on UT Health Austin's contact tracing team for those infected with COVID-19 in the Austin area.
We collect information on all of the people that they've contacted while they were in their infectious period. And then we use that information to call those people and then assess whether or not those people need to get tested or whether they should be in quarantine or isolation.
Basinger says she feels like this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and she's glad to have played a part.
I feel like by being able to be on this team, I'm able to contribute a little bit, and that contribution, it feels really good to know that I'm helping to make a difference.
Which brings us back to graduation, when Del Med will launch new doctors into a global pandemic. For Ava Karimi, the thought of graduation day had been the thing that fueled her for so long. But COVID-19 has shattered all the pomp and circumstance of that day and left her and her classmates with a sobering reality.
I now have a better understanding of what I signed up for. And I have some time to think about it and know what it entails and what I need to do. What I can tell you is that I'm definitely more ready now than I was a month ago.
Karimi begins her residency in internal medicine at Del Med in July. She's not sure what to expect, but she tells me she chose to go to medical school to help people. So that's what she'll do. I'm Nadia Hamdan in Austin.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. San Antonio's Catholic parishes will resume in-person services next week as the state continues to gradually reopen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios reports the Archbishop delivered an aerial blessing over the city's churches yesterday.
The bells of San Fernando ring as Archbishop Gustavo Garcia Sierra flies overhead in a small plane. The plane circled around 31 parishes in San Antonio and New Braunfels on Monday to deliver a blessing from the skies. After the flight, the Archbishop admitted the pandemic is not over, but he believes churches will bring hope.
I never thought that I will be in my lifetime seeing something like that, that we needed to close the church for safety. And we have done it, and today they are open.
Starting May 19th, the parishes of the Archdiocese may reopen to the public. Mass will resume the weekend of May 23rd with social distancing policies in place. The announcement to reopen comes as Texas reports around 40,000 cases of COVID-19, and that number grows by about 1,000 cases every day. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
The two Democrats vying for the chance to challenge Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn in November will debate next month ahead of the upcoming primary runoff election. KUT's Becky Fogel reports the event will be televised and streamed online.
The debate is set for June 2nd during the Texas Democratic Convention. Air Force veteran M.J. Hagar and State Senator Royce West of Dallas will have the chance to explain to voters why they're the best candidate to unseat Cornyn, who's running for a fourth term in the U.S. Senate. The primary runoff election, which was originally set for May 26, was pushed back to July 14th due to the coronavirus pandemic. The debate will be broadcast live on more than a dozen NextStar TV stations throughout Texas, including ones in Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston. The forum will also be streamed live on the Texas Democratic Party's Facebook page.
And early voting for the primary runoff begins Monday, June 29th. Texas home sales fell 14%, 0.4% in April compared to the previous month. That's according to projections Texas A&M University's Real Estate Center released Monday. They show how the first full month of statewide social distancing measures has impacted the Texas housing market. Houston saw the steepest decline among the major metro areas, with sales activity down 17%. The report cites a reluctance of buyers and sellers to visit homes in addition to a downturn in the Texas economy. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The path that food takes from a pasture to your plate is designed for a society that does not currently exist. Traditional supply chains and demand trends have been completely disrupted by COVID-19, along with almost everything else. The price for cattle has tanked, so too dairy and poultry, and it's unclear what cotton demand is going to look like, given that fewer people will be buying clothes. The economic wreckage seems almost too great to tally, and yet the folks at Texas A&M appear to have done just that in a new report that takes a holistic look at the effects of COVID-19 on Texas agriculture. Here to tell us more is one of its authors, Joe Outlaw. He is the co-director of the Agriculture and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M University. Professor Outlaw, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Well, thanks for having me.
When you tallied up the potential losses from all the crops and livestock produced here in Texas, what was the final number that you arrived at, Professor?
Well, at this point, it's a pretty good guess, but it's $6 to $8 billion is what we're looking at if things don't change prior to crop harvest. My $6 to $8 billion is really kind of on the low side, meaning that it could be much higher.
When you say $6 to $8 billion, are you talking about in year one, or what is the time frame that you have?
In the 2020 year, this calendar year.
Is there any way of knowing, like, if everything were to stop today and return to normal, how bad the impact would be? I mean, maybe that's taking it too far down the line.
Well, it's so difficult because, as you mentioned in your open, the food supply chain is, I don't want to say it's broken, but it is severely damaged. And getting the livestock side, especially right now with the feed yards being backed up because the packing plants, a lot of them have closed due to the virus. And when that happens, that disrupts everything, and it sends bad price signals down all the way to the cow-calf producer. And so it's kind of difficult at this point to say. Our initial report there says $6 to $8 billion, and I feel very comfortable that if that could easily be the low side of things.
But it sounds like you're describing vulnerabilities in the supply chains that have been there all along. It's just that they're making their presence felt right now, right?
Right. And you know, I use this term a lot, the just-in-time marketing chain where, you know, just like milk and why it was dumped. And when schools close and the other restaurants started closing, that's a big segment of milk, fluid milk consumption. And so, you know, it's a perishable product and it has to go somewhere like that to be drank, or it needs to be processed. And if it's in the wrong place to be processed, meaning there's not a cheese plant or butter plant somewhere, then that's what happens. You get dumping. And so, you know, when you work on a system that's used to working flawlessly, or mm-hmm. at least to most people, it appears to be flawless, and you start having problems, then everybody can see what's wrong.
Professor, are there any commodities that are pandemic-proof? If you're a farmer, is there anything you can do at this point?
Well, you know, it's kind of crazy because all this happened right after, kind of in Texas, planting decisions had been made. People had bought seed, and then all this happened. But really, there's two crops that have actually come out of this in better shape than they have been recently, and that's rice and wheat. And not better in terms of they're doing great, but relatively speaking, their prices are either held at not too good levels, but they've held, or they're actually higher than they had been prior to all these problems. Because
well, now, why rice
staples,
and wheat?
Rice
staples.
And wheat are food staples around the world, and it's kind of unprecedented. If a person had rice to sell, they could sell it for more right now than they could have for the last 10 years.
Wow.
But the problem is Texas producers don't store this long from last year's crop. So there isn't really rice to be had. That's why the price is so high.
Any relief in sight for Texas producers, Professor?
Well, certainly. If we can get more people to going back to food service, because that made up about half of how people used to eat before.
You're talking about restaurants and that sort of thing?
Yes, mm-hmm. All the institutional things, restaurants, hospitals, schools. Once the supply chain was geared up to serve institutional products, and now suddenly we didn't have that market anymore. Getting that geared back up will certainly get us back to closer to normal, but this is going to take a while to work through. I have no idea how long that would be, but I would say if we went back to business as usual in the economy, it's still going to take the supply chain a while to catch up.
Joe Outlaw is co-director of the Agriculture and Food Policy Center at Texas A&M University. Professor Outlaw, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Sure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At-home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
Hello, my name is Martin Hertz, and we have a family music store for over 53 years here in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, not Victoria, Texas. I've been amazed at what has happened in the last 6 to 8 weeks regarding the coronavirus. We thought our music store would be having big problems, but all of a sudden, everybody started coming to us to get accordions. They're going to Sugar Land, Texas. They're going to, what's the name? Is Amarillo? We actually have done more in the last 2 months than the year before. People asking, you know, I'm bored, I've got nothing to do, I'm done with Netflix and all the different movie channels and things like that, and I got to do something constructive. So I've got the gamut from 18-year-olds to 92-year-olds. Lately, I've been getting people asking, I want to play the theme song from this video game. Over the last few years, I would say mostly girls in their 20s, 30s, asking for an accordion because they heard the accordion in the movie Amelie. It's every kind of style. Like, I'm flabbergasted at what's inspiring people to play the accordion. The one thing about the accordion, too, it doesn't have any borders. It's played in almost every country in the world. How to buy a used accordion. When you open the case, put your nose in it, and just smell. And if you smell any mustiness or moldiness, close the case and buy the bicycle or go do something, find something else that you might want. That's the worst thing, because the accordion is made of wood, metal, leather, cardboard, and paper is in there. And none of those things like moisture. Then the next thing you do is you press the switches that indicate that they have one dot on them or there's a single reed, and you play every single note in and out. You can listen and hear that each one is working both ways and in tune with each other. And just pull the bellows, open them and close them without pushing any buttons or any keys. And if it's moving very easily, that means you've got problems with no compression. All these things are expensive things to fix. So stay away from it. The most expensive accordion we sold was $25,000. Brand new. Most of the accordions that people are buying are in that $400-$500 up to $1,500 range. That's where bulk of the sales in the last 6 weeks has been. It's amazing. Thanks for listening to me. I hope you all practice safe squeezing. My name is Martin Hurt, and don't forget, you are listening to the Texas Standard.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Of the almost 41,000 COVID-19 cases counted in Texas, almost 3% have proven fatal. San Antonio musician Stephanie Key is a survivor. As Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan reports, Key, now fully recovered, is striking back.
Lovers of classical music have seen Key for the last 18 years playing clarinet with the San Antonio Symphony. Key is also a distance runner and mountain climber, so she listens very carefully to her body. Not long ago, it began telling her something wasn't right.
I'd been able to say, it's just this time of the year, allergies, or, I just ran too hard today, so that's why my ankles ache.
Finally, in late March, there was something she couldn't ignore.
When the fever just literally flooded my body, I realized, oh my God, I've got this.
She called her doctor, who recommended she take aspirin and give it one more day. In the meantime, the San Antonio Symphony had devised a neat little shelter-in-place video project that allowed them to be a symphony again, if only on video.
Yeah, I made that video Thursday night, the 26th, when I had the fever.
Each symphony member recorded themselves at home, and all their videos would be edited together later.
I think I needed that kind of focus in this time of anxiety and panic.
The next day she was still sick, so her doctor sent her for a COVID-19 test, which took 3 to 5 days for results. She went home and back to bed, fighting a relentless fever.
Throw the covers off, and then you'd get cold, you'd pull the covers back on, and that was really the toughest part, was just being so uncomfortable at night.
Her biggest fear wasn't rooted in the present. COVID-19 often does lung damage, lungs that are a critical part in playing clarinet. She wondered if her symphony days were numbered.
A couple times I remember waking up in the middle of the night and sitting up and just forcing myself to breathe as deeply as I could, just to kind of see, what is it? Do I feel anything? Am I experiencing anything else, or is this just anxiety?
She didn't have to face down her fears alone. Husband David Molinauer, a cellist with the San Antonio Symphony, was always nearby. But did her husband get sick too?
The incredible thing is, it seems like he's asymptomatic. He hasn't shown a single symptom or anything.
And the ironic twist, if you don't show symptoms, you can't get a test. That weekend was a long one, waiting for those results.
My fever was kind of hovered around 101 the whole time.
But then she turned a corner.
On Monday morning, my fever was gone. So I had a very short experience with this from Thursday afternoon to Monday morning.
Had this been COVID-19?
On Tuesday morning at 8 a.m., the phone rang, and it was a woman telling me that I tested positive.
By the time she found out, the worst had largely passed.
It was pretty apparent I was one of the luckier ones with a milder case, I guess you could say. But the protocol was the same. Don't leave your house for another week.
In the weeks since she's emerged from the worst of it, she's back to her regular routine, including running. But she also plans to help fight back. Those who recover from COVID-19 have antibodies in their plasma that may attack the virus. And she plans on giving plasma as soon as she can. She's grateful that she survived, but bothered by what she still sees all around her.
Well, I think what bothers me the most now is seeing people out there absolutely taking no heed. I mean, people are dying every day because of this same thing that I had. It's very hard to stomach.
She asked her doctor if there's anything else she can do. His advice was short and sweet.
What you can do is keep making beautiful music.
The San Antonio Symphony's next season will begin in September. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Much of American life has been on pause over the last few months, but other things are still moving right along, including a plan to move radioactive nuclear waste to West Texas. The proposal for a facility on a remote part of the Texas-New Mexico border has been up in the air for years. Now a new federal report says it should be approved because it would not lead to significant environmental problems. Travis Bubenik has long been following the ups and downs of this plan. He's a West Texas-based reporter for Courthouse News Service. Travis, great to have you back on the big broadcast. Good to talk with you again.
Yeah, good to be here.
So let's begin with a review of matters. What would this facility do exactly?
So basically, there's an existing low-level waste site, as they call it, there in Andrews County on the Texas-New Mexico border, that has been housing nuclear waste for years, stuff like contaminated rags, syringes from, you know, labs and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Now, this proposal would kind of up the ante on the kinds of waste that would be stored there. And basically, what this company has long wanted to do is take the growing problematic stockpile of the nation's high-level nuclear waste, and that's basically used-up nuclear fuel at nuclear power plants all around the country, and ship it out here to West Texas. And they call it a temporary storage solution. What that means is they would store this high-level nuclear waste for potentially decades until the United States can figure out, okay, where do we actually dispose of all this stuff?
What's happening with this nuclear material in the meantime, and what would happen to it otherwise if this were not a go?
Well, basically, it is sitting at the power plants, and it's piling up. I mean, we're still making nuclear power, you know, and this has been the issue for years. And, you know, advocates who say we need to find a site, one site to store this stuff until we can figure out the disposal solution say, you know, we've got all these potential targets for bad actors all over the country, these stockpiles of waste. And they say it's better to have one solution instead of having this stuff basically all over the country sitting with nowhere to go.
What about what this could mean for Andrews County? I mean, surely there must be, I would imagine, some kind of, financial upside?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have money coming in. There are various estimates as to what it would do for the local economy. I mean, maybe you'd have a few more jobs and certainly a much bigger tax base from this operation because you'd have federal funding. The other side of it is the environmental concerns. I mean, you know, environmental advocates for years have said this is a bad idea, not just to bring it to a site, wherever that site may be, but to ship it by rail across the country. They're worried about, you know, potential accidents, spills. Again, the prospect of terrorists targeting these moving transports of nuclear waste. So there are all kinds of environmental concerns that come along with it for people opposed to this idea.
So what's the next phase? What's the next shoe to drop here?
So this is far from a done deal, but what's happening now basically is that the staff of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission say, hey, we've reviewed the environmental impacts. We don't think they'd be significant enough to warrant not doing this. So we do think it should have the stamp of approval. But, you know, regulators are going to take comments on that. You know, a final environmental report might not come out until this time next year. Mm-hmm. And then regulators would have to make the final decision. But here's the thing. Even when that's all said and done, let's say they do finally approve this West Texas plan, there's a rival company just across the Texas border in New Mexico that wants to do the same thing, to do this, to bring high-level nuclear waste to one site somewhere in the country, wherever it is. You've got to have Congress on board, and that is far from certain. Congress has not been able to agree on a solution for this problem for years. There's nothing indicating that they will decide that West Texas is the answer.
I'm wondering, where's the governor of Texas on all this?
So Abbott has in the past indicated that he's not really into the idea of expanding the kinds of nuclear waste brought to this West Texas site. I mean, he's been pretty quiet on it, but he has made some statements opposing that idea. So ultimately, the decision is not going to be his alone, but I think that where he comes down on this at the end of the day could definitely have some political influence on it.
Is COVID-19 slowing the process down, by the way, when it comes to making a decision?
Yeah, a little bit, only really to the extent that the public comment period for this environmental report is just going to be up for a little bit longer. So, you know, giving stakeholders, advocates, the public a little bit more time to get on there and give their feedback.
Travis Bubenik is based in West Texas, where he's a reporter for Courthouse News Service. Travis, good to have you back on the broadcast. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, let's find out about the talk of Texas, shall we? Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back with us. Hello there, Wells.
Howdy, David. Some interesting polling from the Washington Post and Ipsos assessing what folks across the country think of their governor's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Lots of people talking about this one on social media, and there are some interesting findings here in Texas. Governor Greg Abbott near the bottom of approval ratings for the governor's poll, with 57% of Texas respondents approving of his leadership. That's second to last, with only Georgia Governor Brian Kemp coming in lower at 39%. By comparison, Ohio Republican Governor Mike DeWine and New York's Democrat Andrew Cuomo, they both get top marks for handling the coronavirus, with approvals over 80%. Here's where things get interesting, David. As I mentioned, Greg Abbott still gets a majority of support for his handling, 57%. But roughly the same percentage of respondents, 59%, also feel the state is opening up too quickly. And that's pretty interesting, especially considering that the governor is the one person with the authority to push for a bigger and faster reopening. So to me, it seems like maybe the biggest poll finding here is that sort of disconnect, or rather the fact that some of the respondents haven't made that connection. Lots of interesting stuff to parse in there, though. We've shared it on our Facebook page. We'll be tweeting it out from the Texas Standard Twitter account here momentarily. Lots more comments on Facebook about the Texas reopening. Marianne Taylor calls for more testing and notes that it leads to more positives, which isn't a big surprise. She says everyone can decide what they want to do. Of course, some employers need workers. Wash your hands, wear masks and gloves, take baby steps. There's no way we can stay closed up forever. However, Jeanne Wilkinson says that she recalls her mother's words of advice, like some of those experts out there: just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. So folks still divided on the merits and whatnot of reopening
like
these Texas businesses, David, for sure. Speaking of experts, yeah, where that's another issue or event that we're keeping an eye on via social media today. Facebook, that hearing, United States Senate hearing with Dr. Anthony Fauci and others there speaking about the national response to the coronavirus pandemic. Have that video streaming on our Facebook page. And it's interesting, you know, as someone who's attended his fair share of Zoom meetings in the past few months, it's it's interesting to see how our elected officials and government employees, how they're handling it there as well.
Yeah, it is rather interesting. Been stopping by and taking a look at. They got it streaming in several websites online. There's it's interesting what Fauci is having to say about. He's the nation's top infectious disease expert, of course. His message at odds definitely with President Trump's "things are looking up" argument. It's really fascinating testimony. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at TexasStandard.org. You can keep up with everything 24/7. We're going to be back here for the big broadcast tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.